Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. And I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. It's a happy new year for some people. The billionaires dance and play in their monthly $75 billion in quantitative easing dollars. So easy for them. Just take those lousy, marked up, messed up mortgages and turn them in. Get your $75 billion while half the nation now endures life with no job or a lousy job and skimpy food access due to their now reduced food stamps. Like, food stamps weren't low enough. Yeah, oh yeah. It was just too much money for those food stamps. So now they're reduced, sharply reduced, and unemployment insurance has been cut off dead for millions. So much for insurance. And, hey, that three-year-old can of soup doesn't look too rusty now, does it? Well, don't cut your finger opening it, because we don't have a national health service like civilized countries do. Obamacare ain't health care. It's insurance company profit care. Who knows if you can get through the crowd at the ER if it's to the point of blood poisoning. So happy new year 2014, but this is the year we fight back. Stay tuned. Now coming up, I want to talk about a couple of things. One of them is that social transformation is actually happening. And if you look over the past few years, if you really chart things out, you can see that, the billionaires have a problem, a great big problem. But first, I want to start with a situation that is news that you need to know, and that is that there's a nasty flu virus about. I want to talk about just how nasty it is. This from Recombinomics commentary, Recombinomics.com. That's Henry Nyman's website. He's been on this show before. Quoting Seton officials, that's Seton Hospital in Austin, Texas, saying the last couple of weeks the number of flu patients doubled from about 200 to 400 confirmed cases, and five patients with the H1N1 virus were put on a special heart-lung machine to help them breathe. Administrator Weingarten says the procedure is complex and often requires a team of over 35 physicians, nurses, perfusionists, and respiratory therapists for each individual ECMO case, which does not include the team of lab technicians that provide critical life-saving patient information. Patients require 24-hour care while they are connected to the device, which may last a few days or several weeks. And if you're wondering what sort of machine we're talking about, the ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. And I'm getting this from Wikipedia. It's an extracorporeal, meaning outside the body, technique of providing both cardiac and respiratory support oxygen to patients whose hearts and lungs are so severely diseased or damaged that they can no longer serve their function. Initial cannulation, that means shoving the catheter in there, of a patient receiving ECMO is performed by a surgeon or anesthetist, and maintenance of the patient is the responsibility of the perfusionist or the ECMO specialist, who gives 24/7 monitoring care for the duration of the treatment. There are several forms of ECMO, the two most common of which are being veno-arterial and veno-venous, and there's more details on that. So what I'm talking about is just looking at, getting our telescope out and looking at Austin, because that's where we have a little bit of information. You can see that the influenza there is so severe that all five of the extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, basically heart-lung machines, are in use. And that's all they have. That's how severe this flu can be. Meanwhile, the total human cost of the 2009 swine flu epidemic has gone up, as I have long predicted. The New York Times quotes the World Health Organization saying that when the numbers are adjusted for people who died immediately after the flu ravaged their hearts and lungs, 400,000 people died worldwide. This is still a very low number, in my opinion. Very low, as it's culled only from those who A, made it to the hospitals before dying, and B, who were specifically tested for flu. And I remember that testing, those incidents were few and far between, and there were some problems with the test itself in getting a positive. Remember, too, that the thousands who died in the U.S. did so out of the normal flu season, when only a couple of flu deaths were expected. Now, this flu is coming up a little late in the flu season, which could make it worse in February. So now this is where I get unscientific and simply speak from my experience. The flu, yes, can be dangerous. Generally speaking, it kills older people and very young people. This is the swine flu again, and the swine flu was known in 2009 for killing, healthy teenagers, and rather rapidly. So this is something to pay attention to, and the way I've learned to pay attention to it, just from my own unfortunate experience, is that if you get high fever, you find out it's the flu. Generally speaking, it comes with body aches. Again, I say this is unscientific. This is from my experience. You've got a lot of fever. You're weak. Your body aches. You feel like hell. That's probably the flu. Go and have it tested if you can. If it goes on and on, and you get just past the point where the fever breaks and you're starting to feel better, and all of a sudden you get a much higher fever, then you're really in trouble, because there's a good chance that you just got pneumococcus in your lungs, which is eating up the tissue that was ravaged by the H1N1 virus. And that can kill you quickly. And that's where you need antibiotics. Fortunately, pneumococcus responds pretty well to antibiotics. But I say that because you may see on billboards, et cetera, don't take antibiotics for a virus, which is very true, specifically speaking. And but it's a way to blame you for a problem that actually comes out of the livestock industry. That's why the livestock industry is the primary reason that antibiotic resistance has spread so rapidly. And I suppose there is some additional statistical evidence that that happens with people who take or have taken, this is much more common in previous decades, have taken antibiotics every time they get the flu. Obviously, you don't want to take antibiotics every time you get the flu, but as I was saying, the bacteria can come in with the flu or after the flu, can be quite disastrous. And there is some evidence that at least portions of the great influenza in 1918 fatalities were mostly actually caused by pneumococcus immediately after influenza, and it was H1N1, ravaged the lungs. So what I'm saying here is be careful, look after yourself, and pay attention particularly to those particular symptoms, because you might be needing some help and you might need antibiotics if you get to that point. From Truth Out, we'll talk about this Happy New Year where the billionaires are dancing. In the past months, we've seen a federal judge rule that Detroit can go bankrupt, putting its workers' pensions in jeopardy. And we've seen Illinois' legislature vote for substantial cuts in its retirees' pensions. Undoubtedly, these two actions are just the tip of the iceberg. We have opened up a new sport for America's elite, pension theft. The specifics of the situations are very different, but the outcome is the same. Public employees who spent decades working for the government are not going to get the pensions that were part of their pay package. In both cases, we have governments claiming poverty, and therefore the workers are just out of luck. But before getting to the specifics of these cases, it's worth dealing with a couple of points. First, there's been a huge media campaign to trumpet the generosity of public sector pensions. The Washington Post once ran a major front page article on public pensions in which its poster child was a former official in a small California city who was getting a pension of more than $500,000 a year. Of course, this sounds horrible, and it is. The official had been the city manager and had assigned himself several other top jobs, all of which came with generous pensions. He was also under indictment. I want to stop right there. That's a beautifully effective conservative technique for controlling your brain. It works really well. If you're old enough, maybe you remember welfare Cadillacs. Welfare queens on Cadillacs. When Ronald Reagan ran in 1980, he decided that he could get the white male vote by working on racial fears. So he went to, I believe it was Philadelphia, Missouri, a town known for lynching, and started his campaign. And the silent, you know, the dog whistle cues were out. And he also put out these stories. I say he put out, his team put out these stories of the welfare Cadillac, and it really didn't matter whether there's a shred of truth to it or not, and of course there really substantially was not. It was just a matter of getting the meme in to get people to hate each other. It works really well, and with this story, the $500,000 a year pension for a former California city official. Yeah, that's another welfare queen, okay? Get it? Because it's a story that'll stick in your head, but it does not represent the situation, and it most certainly will turn you from the truth. Now, returning to the article from Truth Out, this is not close to the typical pension in California or anywhere else. In the case of Detroit, the typical pension is a bit more than $18,000 a year. I said $18,000 a year, $18,000 a year. That's your pension. I was talking about rusty soup cans. Yeah. In Illinois, it's around $33,000 a year. It's important to note that most Illinois workers do not get Social Security. So this is their whole retirement income. The other item generally missing from the coverage is that these pensions are part of workers' pay. Controlling for education and experience, public sector pay is somewhat lower than the pay of private sector workers. The more generous pension and health care benefits that most public sector workers enjoy are offsetting lower wages. The pensions are not gifts bestowed by the government on workers. They are part of workers' pay. The pensions are part of workers' pay. When the city of Detroit or state of Illinois cut workers' pensions, they are in effect saying that they are not going to pay workers for the work that they did. Now, departing from this article again, you're going to see this right here in Portland, Oregon, where TriMet, the local bus authority, is looking to utterly destroy the union. In my opinion, I have looked at the negotiation points, if that's what you call them. The offers from TriMet are so outrageous against the union, trying to undercut everything that makes the union job a good job. They go on and on and on and on. They will not justify those cuts and rollbacks and tightenings and worsenings when the negotiations come up. And it's becoming obvious that the reason they don't want to do that is because they've decided what they really want to do is to have the offer refused so that they can then go to a judge. And the deal is, this is the cute part, the judge has to choose one offer or the other. Now, judges, ask yourself, you know any judges? Mad a few? Would you say they're a little on the conservative side? Would you say that after years and years of dealing with people who do not have the impressive amount of education that they have, that judges kind of tend to maybe look down a little bit on people who are just blue collar? And do you think that a judge would be inclined right off the bat to take the union's offer? No, they're trying to bust the bus drivers here. And let me tell you, if they succeed to the extent that I think they want to, you're going to see another little mortgage crisis while all the bus drivers eventually, you know, if it just keeps going this way, and the union is busted. Just watch the mortgages drop like flies in Portland, Oregon. And that's part of that oh-so-effective conservative meme that Jim Hightower calls, "Let's you and him fight." Let's you, all of you listening to me, many of whom, half of whom, are having difficulty getting by and need food stamps. Let's get you to seethe with resentment at bus drivers while the billionaires dance and sing. Works great, doesn't it? Want to go there? It's your choice. Returning to the article, Detroit workers might be forgiven if they thought they could count on getting the pensions for which they worked. After all, the Michigan Constitution prohibits the state from cutting pensions, and the city of Detroit is a creation of the state of Michigan, which might have led them to believe that the Michigan Constitution also applied to Detroit. However, a federal judge just ruled otherwise. Now, Detroit workers face the prospect of a bankruptcy judge taking large chunks out of their pensions. There's more on that. You can find it at Truth Out. I found it linked to at dollarsandcents.org, which is also a very useful website to have close to you. Now, I want to turn to more upbeat thoughts here, because after all, it is the new year. And the fact is, there's something to look forward to. And I'm referring to an article in Alternet by Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers. And they're talking about how Bill Moyers charted out the path of success for social movements. And just cutting into the middle of it, they write, "Moyer's work is heartening for social justice activists because it shows how movements grow, recede, and change their functions at different stages. By understanding the current stage of development, we can better define the work that must be done to achieve success and predict how the power structure and public will react to our actions. Moyer worked with Dr. Martin Luther King at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference on Poverty Campaigns. He also worked on a variety of causes over his nearly 50-year career in social movements. In a recent conversation, Ken Buttigieg, a peace and justice activist who worked with Moyer, said that Moyer wrote the first draft of the 8 stages of successful social movements, that number 8 being important to what I'm about to pass on here, when he was jailed with more than 1,400 people protesting the Seabrook nuclear power plant in 1977. Remember that, the Clamshell Alliance? Anyway, Buttigieg explained that one reason Moyer wrote the 8 stages was so people involved in movements would not despair when the movement did not immediately succeed. Yeah, I'm talking to you, and yeah, I'm thinking about Occupy. What, did it just go away? No. Things are much better than you think. They seem to disappear without success. These are expected stages of development. Just as we would not expect a fourth grader to be doing calculus, we cannot expect a social movement to jump from stage 2 to the success of stage 7. Each step in the 8-step process serves an important rule. Using the movement action plan as a guide, we see that we are closer to success than one might think. The Occupy movement was stage 4 of 8, as Moyer describes it, quoting, "New social movements surprise and shock everyone when they burst into the public spotlight on the evening TV news and newspaper headlines. Overnight, a previously unrecognized social problem becomes a social issue that everyone is talking about. It starts with a highly publicized, shocking incident, a trigger event, followed by a nonviolent action campaign that includes large rallies and dramatic civil disobedience. Soon these are repeated in local communities around the country," and that's quite similar to what happened with Occupy. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. I'm on my transmission to transform the society, if I can help in that. Returning to this article, referring to Bill Moyer's stages, stage 4 is where we're at. Stage 4 of 8, the social movement takeoff. During Occupy, it seemed that suddenly the unfair wealth divide, the corruption of Wall Street, and the dysfunction of government came into people's consciousness. These issues were discussed in the media, and politicians started using language to show that they understood that there was a problem. Prior to this, these issues were largely ignored, taboo topics that were not on the political radar. And once again, speaking for myself, seems like we have a pope come lately. Why didn't the Almighty Holy Father have anything to say about that during Occupy? Yes, me, I don't think he was so holy, but then that's not my business, is it? Because I'm not a Catholic. But anyway, in stage 4, there are 3 concepts about which the public must be convinced. The first was accomplished during Occupy. That is, there is a problem that must be confronted. We also began to accomplish the second concept. Current conditions and policies must be opposed. During later stages, the second goal will be broadened and expanded. The final concept, and this is still ahead of us, is that people no longer fear the alternatives, but want the alternatives put into place. This is where I step away from the text once again and say, hello there, I'm an anarcho-socialist. Always have been. Well, always enough, anyway. And I say that we can cooperate and develop usable, hands-on, transparent systems for running our society without being ruled by billionaires. Stage 5 is a state of identity crisis and powerlessness. Participants feel like they failed, and commentators say that the movement is dead, sound familiar, and accomplished nothing. Some of the people involved in the takeoff get burned out and suffer despair and hopelessness. In fact, this is as natural as the receding of a wave, and as Bill Moyer points out, quote, "The perception of failure happens just when the movement is outrageously successful," end quote, because it raises the consciousness and national awareness of a serious problem that was previously ignored. And that was what I was talking about before when I was saying, hey, the door to class consciousness has been cracked open and there ain't no going back. It's not locked anymore. Returning to that alternate article, Moyer quotes the I Ching, Book of Changes, an ancient Chinese text which dates back to the 3rd or 2nd millennium BCE for guidance. The I Ching describes retreat as a time of inner conflict based on the misalignment of your ideals and reality, i.e. the unrealistic expectation that long-term goals can be achieved immediately. This is a time to retreat and take a longer look to be able to advance later. We know many in Occupy who did just that before moving on to stage 6, where we are now. During the stage of identity crisis or retreat, activists who step back may realize we actually created a massive grassroots-based social movement. I just want to say that part of the sentence again. Activists who step back may realize we actually created a massive grassroots-based social movement. put our issues on the agenda, and gained majority support for many of our views. In addition, people began to learn of the enormity of the problem, agonize over the suffering of the victims of the unfair and corrupt economy, and realize the complicity of people in power that they trusted. The essential lesson to stage five is that resistance from the power structure is the normal stage of the process. When we step back and look at the course of history with the overall framework of change, the movement is on the path to success. We need to understand what the power holders already know, that political and social power ultimately lies with the people. Often simultaneous with this feeling of powerlessness is stage six, majority public support, which is where we are right now. During the current phase, the movement seeks to create broad and deep consensus over the issues that have been raised in the takeoff. Our job is to win over the hearts and minds of the American people. The movement must consciously undergo a transformation from spontaneous protest operating in a short-term crisis to a long-term popular struggle to achieve positive social change. It needs to win over an increasingly larger majority of the populace and involve many of them in the process of opposition and change. The majority stage is a long process of eroding the social, political, and economic supports that enable the power holders to continue their policies. It is a slow process of social transformation that creates a new social and political consensus, reversing those of normal times. During this phase, the movement must transform from a loose organizational model to an empowerment model. This requires more structure, but in order to be effective and create lasting change, it must follow the principles of being participatory, democratic, efficient, flexible, and capable of lasting over the long haul. Now, turning from that article again, I see much of this happening with Occupy. One of the greatest things that I noticed locally about Occupy was the constant effort to keep things as participatory as possible, sometimes to the point of tediousness. But I think that's all right, because this was the first time for us trying to create that other way of coming to decisions. We used consensus process a great deal. I'll say that again. We used consensus process a great deal. And in that consensus process, there was an effort to hear everyone and not to simply pick a majority, throw up a vote, and bulldoze over the opposition, which, as we see, often creates, well, opposition and bitterness and power fights. And instead, again and again, in larger and smaller groups, I saw people get together at Occupy and using skilled coordinators, some of whom learned their skills right on the spot, find out what the group wanted to do. And it was just a beautiful thing, because there is a pool of creativity that can be created when people get together and decide to cooperate and decide to find out what is in each other's minds and decide collectively, without hierarchy, without competition, which combination of those ideas is best for everyone involved. That's the collective mind at work. And the collective mind, the pool of creativity, is greater than the individual mind. And I think we'll see more of this, and it's very encouraging. So happy New Year 2014. I may have some more to say on that in a minute, but I want to move ahead to some news articles. I want to make sure that I get to. One of them is latest on Fukushima, and I'm choosing RT for this, Russia Today. And as I've said before, I don't like everything that Russia Today reports, but it is a different perspective at least. They write that fresh plumes of most probably radioactive steam, and I would correct that to most probably intensely radioactive steam, have been detected rising from the Reactor 3 building at the crippled Fukushima nuclear plant. So the facility's operator company, TEPCO, the steam has been detected by surveillance cameras and appeared to be coming from the fifth floor of the mostly destroyed building housing crippled Reactor 3, according to TEPCO. The steam was first spotted on December 19th for a short period of time, then again on December 24th, 5th, and 7th, 24th, 25th, and 27th, according to a report TEPCO published on its website. The company responsible for the cleanup of the worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl has not explained the source of the steam or the reason it is rising from the reactor building. High levels of radiation have complicated entry into the building and further inspection of the situation. Three of the plant's reactors suffered a nuclear meltdown in March 2011 after the Great East Japan earthquake and the resulting tsunami hit the region. The plant is comprised of six separate water-boiling reactors. At the time of the earthquake, reactor number 4 had been defueled, and reactors 5 and 6 were in cold shutdown for planned maintenance. thereby managing to avoid meltdowns. Unlike the other five reactors, Reactor 3 ran on mixed core containing uranium fuel with plutonium oxide, called MOX. The Reactor 3 fuel storage pond still houses an estimated 89 tons of the plutonium-based mixed oxide nuclear fuel composed of 514 fuel rods. In a similar incident, small amounts of steam escaped from the Reactor 3 building in July 2013, according to Asahi Shimbun in Japan, and however, it was unclear where the steam came from. TEPCO said that radiation levels did not change, adding that the steam could have been caused by rain that found its way to the primary containment of the reactor. And because this vessel was still hot, the water evaporated. On the 23rd of July, the steam was again seen coming out of the fifth floor just above the reactor containment, the Japanese newspaper reported. And you can hear some clicks there. And I am getting 20 counts per minute on the GMC-300 Geiger-Müller counter. That's inside. I was getting 24 outside the KBOO studios. And let me just see if I can go to the text mode and see what... No, I'm not used to it well enough. Ah, here we are. So we're getting 0.11 millisieverts per hour, 22 CPM now, in the KBOO studios. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Stay tuned, because Parafoggering is here with more of the incomparable radio zine on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio and the North Portland Neighborhood Library is proud to sponsor the Jefferson High School 13th Annual Multicultural Film Festival. On January 14th, the documentary The House I Live In explores the risks that prohibition poses to freedom and the tragedy of addicts being treated as criminals. Meanwhile, the prisons of America are growing overcrowded with nonviolent criminals, and illegal drugs are still being sold in schoolyards. This film is being shown on January 14th at the North Portland Neighborhood Library off of Killingsworth Street at 6 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. My name is Parafoggering. And it's the turning of the year, so it's kind of a time to look back and also to look ahead. Try and look a little further ahead than some of our leaders are looking. But let's go back a ways. Here's a date for you. The year 1859. That was the year that America's first commercial oil well was drilled in Pennsylvania. And they struck oil at 69 feet. Well, now we drill miles under the ocean, and we blast away a rock to release these tiny droplets of oil. We drill horizontally. And it's obviously, this is bound to cost more money. You can't do this kind of oil drilling if the price of oil is too low. And the price, that's why right now the price of oil, what they call Brent crude, which is sort of the global oil brand stays around $110 a barrel. If it goes much below that, they're not going to do this kind of drilling because they can't make any money at it. So in other words, we are in, the cheap oil is gone. The cheap oil will never come back. And when we spend $112 a barrel on oil, that is money that is taken away from other things. That's money that cannot go to schools or health care or just ordinary living or anything else. You know, that money goes into just maintaining this energy supply. This money could also be taken away from environmental cleanup. And you can almost foresee a time when some of these oil technologies that really destroy the environment, they're going to come and say, well, it's just too expensive to repair that damage. And so then the climate cost itself could be so high that they're going to try and nickel and dime it. And if the climate cost could be human civilization itself. So that's what we mean when we talk about the cheap oil is gone. And the thing to think about here is that, well, that was money. In other words, maybe we've gotten used to paying $110 a barrel for oil. Not too long ago, the price went up to $150, almost $150 a barrel.